This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. All those food and chef-driven shows on TV aren't just indicative of a national trend. Charlotte is following right along. We have our share of chef-driven restaurants and rising star chefs. Many are homegrown. Others have come from elsewhere. But most seem to share a passion for locally grown foods, not just fruits and vegetables, but meats, too. And some of these chefs insist on serving only local foods in their restaurants. That certainly isn't the easiest way to go, nor is it the most economical necessarily, but these chefs believe that putting local ingredients on your plate is what sets them apart. And we're going to meet three this hour to see why they're so passionate about using local foods. Chef Clark Barlow has been with us before. He's the owner of Heirloom Restaurant in Charlotte. His passion for local food includes something unusual: foraging in the wilds around his restaurant for the freshest ingredients, something we talked about the last time you were here, and we'll talk about it again a little bit. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Good to see you. Chef Paul Verica is owner of Heritage Food and Drink in Waxhaw, also Provisions Food and Drink in Waxhaw, which just recently opened. Exposed to the restaurant business by his family while growing up in Philadelphia, he was introduced to farm-to-table while working in France, and during stints with a number of Charlotte restaurants, he began building the network of local producers that he uses at his Waxhaw restaurant. Good morning and welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
You're welcome. And Chef Chris Coleman is the executive chef at the Asbury restaurant at the Dunhill Hotel. Prior to working there, he spent 11 years at McNinch House, right down the road from the Asbury. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Thank you.
We've talked on and off for several years on this program about local foods, particularly people, the farm-to-fork movement, and people going to farmers markets and actually going to farms to buy food for their table. And this has happened now with increasing frequency, as I said, in restaurants. It seems to be something that's happening around the country. How prevalent is it in Charlotte? How important is it, this local farm-to-food movement within restaurants in Charlotte? I'm not sure to ask that question of.
I think we're at the point now where the majority of Charlotte restaurants are sourcing something locally, and that's a good thing. I mean, even if it's just lettuces or, you know, berries when they're in season, that's great. We are close to the point where a lot of the best restaurants in Charlotte are sourcing nothing but local, which, you mean, you've got three guys around the table who believe in it. So to us, that's important.
Why?
I mean, for me, at the end of the day, it comes down to sourcing good quality ingredients. So whether you're going to source local or you're going to source from New Zealand or Australia, it comes down to buying great quality ingredients to make a great quality dish. Conveniently, here in North Carolina and surrounding states, we have fantastic quality ingredients from so many local farmers. So it makes our job a lot easier as chefs because we have all these people who are growing these fantastic ingredients and raising these fantastic ingredients, and we have such great access to them.
I would have thought that it made your job harder, but you're saying it makes it actually easier, Paul. Is that because you have two restaurants? Is that true for you?
Yeah, it makes it harder, I think, for sure. I mean, I don't know. I probably spend 20 hours a week just talking with farmers, driving. I hit four farmers markets every Saturday mornings. It's a lot harder to do, but like Clark said, it's all about the ingredients, and it's easy to make good food when you have great ingredients, and we are so fortunate to have the farmers around us that we do. We're very, very lucky.
Part
of it's all about the ingredients, yes, but it's also about relationships and about people. When you're buying something from the person who raised the animal or who grew, you know, whatever, it's cool to have that relationship. Say, what's in the field now? How long until we see it? You know, how can we help each other out?
But the restaurant business is the hardest business in the world. Just this, my personal observation. You work 24/7. Your restaurants are open 7 days a week. I mean, not all of yours, but yours, Paul, is.
Yeah, the one is.
So, I mean, you have to go grocery shopping every single day, it would seem to me. And by that, I mean, you don't go to the Harris Theater and do this. And you don't have the big food truck pulling up to the back of the restaurant and dumping stuff off. You're actually going and looking for what you want to serve, and your menu depends on what's available any given day. And you don't always know, I would think. I mean, it's got to make things very difficult.
Well, I mean, that probably is the most difficult part about it, is that you're trying to curate from so many different sources. I mean, I know Paul and Chris can both speak to this. Like, we work with so many people who are, you're going to have a phone call, you're going to have a text, you're going to have an email, or someone's just going to come by and drop off something, and maybe they'll come through this day, and maybe it'll be a different day, and things fluctuate, and things are a little bit different every single day. So there's a lot of different aspects to curating the ingredients, and it's not always that you can pick up the phone at 11 o'clock and call one of the big suppliers and have everything at your door the next morning. Like, but to me, that's what I enjoy about it. I enjoy those relationships, like what Chris said, because that's how you find things that are going to be sort of off the beaten path for chefs. You're going to find things that are just a different ingredient that you never really thought you'd work with before.
Well, and the Asbury is a standalone restaurant, but it also services the Dunhill Hotel. So we are open 7 days a week, all holidays. Paul worked there years ago at the Dunhill and can speak to that. But so we have our restaurant menu. We also have banquets and catering. We have in-room dining. We have bar menu, everything that a regular hotel would have. But we're sourcing local for all of that, which for someone like Clark or Paul who have menus that can change day to day, it's a little bit easier. For us, we have to plan a menu out 2 months in advance for a banquet and catering menu and say, okay, what do we think we might have in November? I mean, we're in August right now. We're planning November parties right now. So what might we have in November? So you see a lot of to be determined on our menus.
If you plan for something and suddenly there's a shortage of something that you planned on having, do you just take that item off the menu, or can you call one of these big food brokers and say, ship me in 20
pounds? You can, but it's not the most ethical way to do it. I think that people who come to our restaurants, to Heirloom, to Heritage, to the Asbury, to Passionate, to all the other places that are doing local things, have that trust with the chef and say, okay, we know that these guys are sourcing locally and seasonally. The menu might not be what I saw online a month ago.
There are a lot of reasons that people want to do this, want to consume local foods, and also why restaurants want to serve locally produced foods. And we'll talk about a lot of those reasons. But one of the things that I'm curious about is, is it worth the effort? Can you really taste
absolutely
the difference?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can so taste the difference. It's amazing. I mean, you look at what right now we're in the peak of tomato season, and I love it, but I'm going to miss it come October, and it's going to suck, and I'm not going to see another tomato until maybe May. And for me, I get excited about it. You know, we have it right now. Let's celebrate it. Let's do as much as we can with it. Let's figure out new ways to cook with it, new ways to play with it, new ways to preserve it, and try and extend those seasons. But it's exciting. It makes it fun.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, I know what Paul was getting ready to say right there is we're always trying to preserve things and take things out of the season because, like Paul said, we're going to miss these ingredients when they go out. So we're trying to figure out ways that are still health department approved for us to take this flavor all the way through into the winter. So whether it's freezing or drying or salting or any of these things that can extend that flavor all throughout the season.
Our chef on assignment, Peter Reinhardt from Johnson & Wales, had a question about heirloom products like Flint corn and Carolina-grown rice or various types of vegetables or breeds of pork that are considered to be heritage breeds. Can you taste the difference there?
I think so.
And is it worth the extra cost?
Yeah, it's just a different it's something different. So to piggyback on Paul's comment about tomatoes, I mean, heirloom tomatoes, everyone knows, I think, at this point what an heirloom tomato is. It's all you see at farmers markets and things. And think about the miles that a tomato had to travel from California or Florida.
Or Mexico
to get here. So that means that they had to pick it while it was not ripe. So it's not at its fullest flavor. We've got a guy who has a farm right down the street from this studio who comes to the restaurant every other day with tomatoes. So he walks less than a mile down the street with tomatoes for us. So he's picking them at their fullest flavor.
Right.
And that just speaks to freshness. But I think with heirloom products, you know, the pork tastes like meat. It doesn't taste like cardboard.
No, things taste like what they are.
Yeah,
like, I mean,
right.
when we get the Ranlew dairy milk, like, to me, when I drink that milk, it tastes like what my grandparents talked about what milk used to taste like. Mm. Or when we get, like, the pork in. Or
well, what does it taste like? I mean, what is it? What's the difference between what you'd pick up at the grocery store and that milk?
All right, so the milk that we have, you've had, like, old ice cream that sort of tastes like that old dairy, like that it tastes like it has full fat, full flavor. It actually tastes like milk, and it tastes like ice cream.
I don't know that I have had that.
Well, then you come in, and I'll give you a glass of milk, and we'll talk about it.
It's like a butterfat thing. There's just a richness to
although
it.
I do remember my grandmother buying milk and skimming the cream off the top, which you don't do anymore.
Right. Not if you're buying bad milk.
recently opened, Paul, Provisions Food and Drink in Waxhaw, which I think is more of a lunch place than a dinner place.
It is. It's a sandwich shop.
Okay. And you advertise fresh food fast.
Yep.
But everything there is locally sourced and made from scratch. How fast can it possibly be?
as much as we can, everything is local. Our deli meats are all coming from Elon, from San Giuseppe. Our cheeses are coming from Ashe County. Our breads are all baked local. All of our produce is local. And it's simplicity. It's really – it starts with Bill's amazing bread from Carolina Artisan bread. And, you know, we have fun with it and take what's around. Like right now, the BLT is probably one of the most popular things on the menu. And it's all about that great bread and that great tomato and the lettuce. And it's simplicity. It really is.
Yeah. Do your patrons appreciate that? Is that the draw?
It's been amazing. The response that we've had to the business has really been – it's been a very welcome surprise. I sleep a little bit easier at night.
And Chris, you've talked at the Asbury about being local, organic, and sustainable in the ingredients that you choose. Sustainability is important, and that's part of being local, isn't it?
Right. It's all about making sure that what we're doing now can be done – 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now. I mean, we have such a great agricultural history in the South specifically and in North Carolina. There's 250 registered farms in the Charlotte metro area. So let's think about how we can help those farmers stay in business so they can pass it along to their kids, who can pass it along to their kids. Let's look back at where we've come from and try to preserve it for the future. That's all about – that's just what sustainability is.
Do you worry that these farmers are going to disappear and become subdivisions at some point in the very near future, given the fact that we're growing so fast?
A lot of them have, and it's kind of sad. But and the average age of a farmer in America today is a lot older than it was even 10 years ago because there's not as much young blood coming into farming. But I think that we've seen – a boom here in Charlotte with the restaurants that have come into shape. There's been farmers who have also, or young people who have jumped into farming.
And to Chris's point, I've noticed it. I've been shopping at York Mount Farmers Market, Regionals Farmers Market, for 10 years. And the number of farmers that we have now is more than doubled from what it was at that time. I mean, 10 years ago, it was Donnie, it was Nisi, it was the Fishers. Small City was there for a little while, and you know, you really didn't have a whole lot. Now there's Bluebird, there's A Way of Life, there's, oh God, so many people I'm probably forgetting. I mean, there's all the meat producers, there's Underwood, there's Gilcrest.
Laughing Owl.
Yeah.
Burton and
Baulkham's. Yeah, there's
so many. All of those places, they're all open to the public as well. But let me just ask you this. You go to a restaurant, a really good restaurant, and the ingredients on the plate look, taste much better than what I get when I go. Is that because you go so early in the morning and get all the guest stuff?
It's a race every Saturday morning. Like I see Paul every Saturday. I mean, I see Chris. I mean, I see Luca. We see Luca.
I see Tim, who started this whole movement in the city. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Miles is usually out there every Saturday. I mean, there's a lot of us. We race every Saturday.
Clark Barlow is the owner of Heirloom Restaurant. We're going to talk about one of the things that he does that I don't think anybody else does, and that's foraging, among other things. Paul Varick is with us from Heritage Food and Drink in Waxhaw, and Chris Coleman is the executive chef of the Asbury Restaurant right across the street from the studio in the Dunhill Hotel. We're going to take a break, come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, celebrating 75 years of providing leadership in the field of neurosurgery on a local and national level. Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates is on the web at cnsa.com. Well, like them or not, charter schools are growing in number in North Carolina. There are 160 here this year, including two online charter schools. They all get tax dollars for every student they enroll, but they're exempt from many of the rules governing traditional public schools, and that raises questions about how we measure the success or failure of charter schools and whether or not they're really making a difference. Lots of questions. We get some answers from a panel of experts and educators on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new report from the Federal Reserve says student loan debt now surpasses what people owe on their cars and credit cards, ballooning student debt, and what the presidential candidates are saying about soaring college costs.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I thought I had cleared my mouth, but evidently not. And that's because Chris Coleman has brought biscuits from the Asbury with jam. And it's not your typical jam. I didn't know what these looked like, apple butter to me. So I thought that's what it was going to be. And in fact, it's bacon and onions and what?
Brown sugar and cider vinegar. It's Benton's bacon from Tennessee, which we think is the best bacon on earth. Onions, equal parts of those, and then you sweat that out and then add some brown sugar and apple cider vinegar and cook it until it gets jam consistency. It's pretty easy.
It's surprising and surprisingly good.
Thank you.
Because I didn't anticipate that. It was like a surprise. Whoa, that's unexpected. He's with us along with Paul Verica, who's the owner and chef at Heritage Food and Drink in Waxhaw. Chris Barlow, who's the owner and chef of Heirloom Restaurant.
Chris Clark.
We're going to talk about. What did I say?
It's I mean, it's Clark.
Yeah. What did I say?
You said Chris. It's okay. Oh, there's a Chris here.
Okay. Like. Clark Barlow is his name with the Heirloom Restaurant. You're known for foraging. We're going to talk about foraging, but you're also known for embracing old school chef tactics, and I'm not sure what they are.
Old school chef tactics. I mean, it's really for us. It's about showing off an ingredient that's maybe been forgotten. For us this year, it's been okra seeds.
Okra seeds.
Yeah. Typically big okra. You let it grow past its prime. Mm-hmm. It's past its tender point. Now, farmers really don't have any use for that. And that was sort of our inspiration for doing this, is all these farms have all this big okra that is going in the compost bin or it's going for animal feed or whatever. And we said, let's find a way to use it. So we split the okra. The seeds just look like Israeli couscous. So we decided to cook them and keep them in that manner. And so we cook them in sort of a risotto style and use them just like an Israeli couscous substitute, because for us, if it doesn't come from North Carolina, we can't use it. So we don't use a lot of Israeli couscous. And then we had the husk, and we said, well, what can we do with these husks? And so we dried them out, turned them into a powder, and they use the same properties as arrowroot powder or cornstarch. So you can thicken soups, thicken sauces with it the exact same way you would.
I'm assuming you've all been to school for this, but I mean, did they teach you this stuff in school? No, you haven't.
No.
Been to school.
No. Yeah. No. And I mean, it's not to say that we don't make mistakes when we're doing stuff like this, mm-hmm. because who knew that okra husk powder would thicken the same way that cornstarch would? So it's one of those things that you try and try things, and then maybe you'll hit one out of every 5 or 10 things that you're actually trying for will actually work out.
Does it change the flavor profile?
The flavor profile of like of a soup that you're thickening?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't really. It's the same exact properties as cornstarch because you've dried it out so much, there's not a lot of okra flavor. But if it did inhibit some sort of okra flavor into it, that wouldn't be a bad thing for me.
But it gets to the other aspect of being local and being responsible. And the reason that you like to be local is it's a responsible use of food. It's a responsible support of local farmers who are feeding their families, that you are feeding people in your restaurants, etc. But it also cuts down on waste when you're talking about what you're doing out there. I mean, do you all do things to cut down on waste? Because obviously that affects your bottom line. Do all restaurants do this, whether they are local or not? Or do they just throw a bunch of stuff away?
Depends on the restaurant. I mean, I know, for example, again, I'll go back to tomatoes because tomatoes are one of the things that are just prevalent right now. We peel 98% of the tomatoes that come into the restaurant. My cooks hate it right now. And we save all those skins, mm-hmm. and we dry out those skins and we turn them into a powder. We use it to flavor pasta. We use it as a plate garnish. We use it however, wherever we can possibly think of. We take all the pulp and the juice, make tomato water out of that, put that in the cryovac bags, if I'm allowed to say that word, and put it into the freezer. You know, it is. It's more expensive. Everything we do is more expensive. And, you know, I look, just looking at my P&L from last month, and I'm like, wow, food cost was up 2%. And I'm like, why? And I'm looking at it. I open up the freezer, and it's the bags of corn. It's the bags of lima beans. It's all the stuff that we've been putting up to be able to pull out over the winter.
Mm. Wow.
Every restaurant has to watch the bottom line. And one thing that we try to teach our young cooks at the Asbury is you're not just putting food on a plate. You're putting dollars on a plate. I mean, everything that you put on a plate costs me money. And the more money we put on a plate that we charge the same amount for, we're going to make less money. So let's think of a way to stretch that dollar. Like, how can we, you know, don't throw the corn husks away. Let's make tamales and run that as a special for lunch. You know, like, let's find a way to everything that comes in the restaurant goes out on a plate instead of out in a trash can.
And something that sort of goes hand in hand with that is the respect for the farmers. Right. Because, I mean, I know we all have the same philosophy there that it is nice to save money and it is nice to watch the bottom line and make as much money as we can off our products. But at the end of the day, I don't want to disrespect any of my farmers by throwing their products away. Like, if something comes into the restaurant, I want to use it to its fullest potential and use it 100%. Because you said before we got started that chefs have the hardest job, and I might agree with you some days, but most days I would say that my farmers have the hardest job.
Okay.
I don't have to wake up at 6 a.m. and till my field and get out there and weed my plants and harvest everything and then drive an hour and a half into Charlotte to drop off to me and then drive 45 minutes to drop off to Paul and drive another half an hour to talk and drop off with Chris and then get back out to the farm and still do another 4 or 5 hours worth of work before I sit back down. I don't have to do that. There are other people that do that, and they do it extremely well, and I want to honor them and respect that, and that's why we use everything that we can.
Do you you mentioned going to farmers markets and shopping the farmers markets. Do you actually deal with farms? Do you rely on certain farms for certain products throughout the year?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm fortunate. I've got two of my main suppliers less than 10 minutes from the restaurant, door to door.
Do they come to you, or do you go to them?
One comes to me, boy and girl, delivered to me a couple times a week, mm-hmm. for both restaurants. They're New Farm and Newtown Farms. Sammy, I usually go to his place. It's my happy place.
Why?
I just love it. I just feel at peace there. I feel at ease. I can look at those fields and I look at what's coming, what's going. You can see everything in front of you, and it always Sammy is just one of those calming, super great guys. He's a dear friend, and it really is. I can go there and be in the worst mood in the world and can go there and I just feel better.
Do you contract with these farmers to supply you with X amount of produce or
no.
Meat product? I don't want to hold them to that, right, and I don't right. think they want to hold us to that. And I mean, for me, it comes down to buying from as many of them as we can, because like Chris was saying with sustainability earlier, we want to sustain all these farms. And for me, I can't buy 100 pounds of tomatoes from one farm. I have to buy 10 from you and 10 from them and 10 from them and 10 from them. So it's really spread out over the course of the season so everybody can sell tomatoes.
Wow, that's a lot of math in your head to keep it, yeah. to be fair about things.
People think we just cook, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, when do you sleep?
I always say we sleep when we're dead.
That's it. Are there things that our local growers do or local food producers do as well as or better than other regions of the country? Are we developing, because we're developing a nice coterie of good restaurants, are we developing something special in the farming world right now that because of you guys and your dependence on them, reliance on them?
Well, I think that, you know, you're probably asking the wrong guys that question, because I think we probably all think that our regional farmers, our local farmers, do almost everything better than other regions, or we wouldn't be sourcing from them. But for me, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier about the agricultural history of this region. And we have a lot of farmers who are buying into that and thinking of ways to grow rice and grow different field peas and corn and things that – different varieties of corn, not just the, you know, bicolor queen corn you see at the mm-hmm. grocery store. But it's looking back at history and saying what grew well here and how can we reintroduce that to today's palates.
When you find a product that's a different variety of corn, or the fact that you're serving okra seeds as a couscous in your restaurant or whatever it may be, do you find that people need to be talked into ordering those things on the menu, or
that's why they're coming to our restaurants.
I mean, I think we're all incredibly fortunate that people give us a lot of trust. Our diners give us a lot of trust. I mean, especially at my restaurant, because with us changing the menu every day, I know that people, when they come in, unless they've looked at the menu that morning online before they're coming, they made the reservation last week, they have no idea what we're going to do on the menu, because I really don't have any idea what we're going to do on the menu until 2 or 3 days ahead of time. And so they're giving us that trust, so we don't have to talk them into menu items. I think it's more about educating the guest and letting them understand where things are coming from, because they're interested in that and they want to know where our products are coming from.
Isn't that exhausting, to try to figure out day to day what's going to be?
I've done the other thing before. Like, I've been in the industry for 13 years now, and so I've written menus that are static menus that never change. And honestly, for Charlotte Restaurant Week, Queen's Feast, I think I'm the only one of us that participates in that. But it's one of those things, like, the menu stays the same for 9 or 10 days. And by the end of day 4, I'm about ready to pull my hair out. Like, I've done that menu. I said,
because you're bored with cooking it?
I'm bored with that menu. Like, I'm tired of doing those dishes. Like, I want to change things a little bit. I want to do things a little bit differently.
But how do you know day to day that what you're cooking up in your head is going to work when you cook it up on the stove and put it on a plate and put it in front of a diner?
Anybody have a good answer to that one?
It just happens. What? You know, I know for me, cooking is just a very natural thing. I remember from being 9 years old, spinning my mother's Lazy Susan of spices and just being able to grab stuff and putting it together, and it worked. And I know I cook most of my stuff in my head before I ever, you know, and then when it's putting it on the plate, it's just tasting it and tweaking it and making it right.
Well, you got the other side of that challenge. If you're planning your menus out months in advance and then suddenly it arrives and you know you're going to sit with that menu for a while.
Right.
Do you get bored as Clark does?
We don't get bored. We look for ways to fine-tune a dish throughout. So by the end of that month and a half, we've had that dish on a menu, it's going to be at its most perfect point. And we like to say that it's going to be most perfect when we put it out. But we all know, I mean, it takes some time to kind of get to know a dish, to get to know how things are going to react on a busy Friday or Saturday night during service. You might not have the extra 30 seconds you had to perfect that sauce. When you're trying to push food out, you've got a full dining room. Mm. So we look for ways to just perfect a dish. And then as far as going piggybacking on what Paul and Clark both kind of talked about with cooking in your head, whenever we sit down and write a menu, we think of flavor components. And we're all trying to balance sweet, salty, bitter, have some umami on the plate, and just find that perfect balance on a plate. Mm. So we say, what ingredient is going to speak to acid? Oh, tomatoes are fantastic. These perfect variety of tomato that has so much acid in it, that can be our acid on the plate. What can be our sweet on the plate? You know, oh, we've got sorghum sitting in the pantry from last year's harvest. What can we do with that? So it is about cooking a dish in your head, and then when you actually pull the ingredients together, perfecting seasoning, salt, pepper, that kind of stuff.
We are in the middle of a drought here in the Charlotte area, and the rest of the state is abnormally dry. What kind of an effect has that had on the farmers that
Ridiculous.
You deal with and on what you can bring into the restaurant?
Ridiculous. I know a small city farm, one of my major suppliers. She's had a miserable season.
Ken hasn't had any rain.
No.
It's been terrible.
No. I mean, she went, almost a month and a half, 2 months without any rain. You know, I'm looking at my menus from this time last year, and what I had available to me then as compared to now, it's crazy. I mean, it did the demo at the farmer's market on Saturday at Matthews, and it felt like the middle of September. It didn't feel like the middle of August because it was just, I mean, potatoes are done already. I had potatoes last year until September and October. It's scary what it's done to the farmers, and I feel for them all. It's a shame.
So what's the long-lasting effect of this going to be as you go into the fall and you come back next spring and it's still dry?
Everybody's planning for fall now. I know a lot of people are planning. You just hope for rain. You hope God works with us, you know?
Mm-hmm. You forage in the woods.
And the rain has been crazy about that. This has been a really interesting year for – I always say that chanterelle mushrooms and tomatoes are mutually exclusive. If you have a great year for chanterelle mushrooms, it means you got too much rain and the tomatoes are going to have a blight. Mm-hmm. If you have a great year for tomatoes, it's been too dry and the chanterelles aren't going to be in a great season. So it's been an interesting year for foraging, and now we're getting a little bit more adapted to where the restaurant is and what we have that's accessible to us. But it comes down to, again, just the respect for the ingredients. It's giving people something, a taste of North Carolina that they haven't had before.
When you were here last time, we talked a lot about foraging, and I'm sure there are thousands of people listening who have not, who did not hear that conversation. So let's go back and go over this a little bit. When I say, when I say foraging, you literally go out on the side of the road.
No, not on the side of the road. Don't make me sound like a crazy person, Mike.
Where do you go?
No, I mean, we have all these nice areas. Like, me and Chris both live in Northwest Charlotte. I love that area of Charlotte because we have so much open land, that's so much parks. It's a nice area of Charlotte, and it's a little bit quieter. And so we have these areas that we can just hop off the road, walk down in, and we've got 5 or 10 acres that we can walk on and find a lot of nice ingredients. And
what do you find as you're walking along the 5 or 10 acres?
Not
on the side of the road.
Yeah. When I was living in Bermuda, I was on the side of the road and people would drive by and, oh yeah, it's crazy. But so now this year we've been finding a lot of juniper berries. The sawbriar tips have been great this year. Green walnuts have been fantastic this year. It's just really a lot of different things. Thistle. I never would have thought that I would have worked with thistle
before. How do you use it?
The same as you would use an artichoke. Thistle is in the artichoke family, so you're going to scoop out that heart of it and then use that as part of a dish. It's something, again, it's just that taste that you haven't thought of before. And when people think about local for me really means a meal of time and place right here.
How do you know you can eat these things? Like thistle, how would you know that, A, you could eat it, and B, it would taste good?
Yeah, for me, you don't really know how it's going to taste because I've never worked with it before, and it's a learning experience for me every time I work with it. But Ben and Nathan from West Hill Farm up in Ashe County were the people who turned me on to thistle, and they said, hey, we've got a ton of it growing on our farm, and would you be okay if we sent down maybe 100 thistle flowers for you? And then, no charge, just try it out and see what happens for you. Mm-hmm. And it works out. So it's one of those things we're trying to do things that are just a little bit different, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't.
Where did this come from in you, this foraging?
For me, it was we wanted to turn back the time and look back at my grandparents' generation and think what they were trying to eat in that generation. And when I talked to my grandmother, I talked to my grandfather, my other grandmother, they talk about these ingredients that they had when they were children growing up. And we wanted to turn back the time and look at that. And when I see ingredients that have been completely lost over the course of 2 generations, my parents' generation now down to mine, nobody would think to eat thistle. Not that I know about. And so we want people to go back and look at those ingredients and see what they can do with those dishes.
You know, somebody made a point on this show a long time ago that years ago that the variety of meats that we consumed was much larger. Today it's chicken, pork, beef. That's pretty much it. Bison, if you go to an adventurous restaurant, would you like to use more things? I mean, would you cook? Would you put squirrel on the menu?
Me personally,
health department lose their mind.
Yeah, we've done rabbit. One of the favorite dishes that we had on the menu when we opened was rabbit nuggets. Mm-hmm. I took it off because the food cost was awful. But yeah, we've done rabbit. We've tried a few other different things. It just didn't work. So much of it is about what the customer wants, and what's the customer going to eat?
Yeah.
You know, it's not as people might think, wow, you get to cook everything you want.
But you just said they trust you.
They do, but there's also dishes I do a dish, at least one dish a week on my menu that, you know, is a crazy dish. And if it sells, it sells. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
It's Paul Verica, who's the owner and chef at Heritage Food and Drink in Waxhaw. Chris Coleman is here from the Asbury, and Clark Barlow from the Heirloom Restaurant. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Scheele Museum, cultivating appreciation for science and nature in the Charlotte metro area for over 50 years, providing a natural adventure on 1500 East Garrison Boulevard, Gastonia. Details at scheelemuseum.org. A new report from the Federal Reserve says student loan debt now surpasses what people owe on their cars and credit cards, ballooning student debt, and what the presidential candidates are saying about the soaring cost of college. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about local chef-driven restaurants and local food, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
They say you are what you eat, so how much media do you consume every day? Are you gorging yourself on everything in sight? Snacking between meals? Sneaking the occasional tweet? I'm Audie Cornish. Look, if you've tried all the other news outlets but just aren't seeing results, check out the All Things Considered diet. Weekdays. More news, less filler.
Hear the latest news from NPR plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered. Weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about local foods being served at local restaurants and the importance of serving those local foods by these restaurateurs. Clark Barlow with the Heirloom Restaurant is the chef and owner there. Paul Verica with Heritage Food and Drink in Waxhaw and Provisions Food and Drink in Waxhaw, which is a lunch place. And Chris Coleman, executive chef at the Asbury in the Dunhill Hotel. We asked a question on social media this morning. How important is local food to you when eating at a restaurant and why? Ben on Facebook writes, it makes up 90% of our decision-making. The other 10% is convenience. But he has a question for you guys. As Charlotte grows in size and farmland makes way for apartments and retail, do you think there will be a time when you have to travel too far for this to make financial sense? Are there any urban farmers?
Yeah, I mean, We've mentioned Kim, Small City, several times on the program. She lives, her farm is really close to where Clark and I live. She's in the city limits. I mentioned Dave a second ago at North End Farms, right here at the north end of North Tryon here. He just has some raised beds, but he brings us whatever he picks out
so
of them.
Farms so farms is a euphemism.
It is. I mean, there's small farms and there's big farms, but they're all farms and they all grow things that we want to eat.
Right.
Yeah, Joey and Scott.
Right, Joey and Scott in Noda.
I mean, that's right in the middle of Noda.
They turn their backyard into a farm. So,
Colin on Facebook writes, it is a deciding factor for my wife and I. We don't go to the box store restaurants. Grow local, support local, and by all means, eat local. From Twitter, it's very important, the local aspect of this. In addition to equality and sustainability, sourcing local also keeps money in the local economy. General question from Karen, who says, can your guests speak to the pervasiveness of corn products in the American diet and alternatives? I'm presuming it's everywhere because it's cheap and heavily subsidized. Of course, corn today is not the same corn as 20 years ago. What about corn? Particularly corn.
Corn is one of my favorite ingredients on earth. I have to be honest. I love it.
Is there something about corn syrup that is really not the negative that you would? In other words, is corn being thought of as a negative product because of corn syrup, which is not corn?
Well, corn syrup is not that awful. High fructose corn syrup is awful. High fructose corn syrup does awful things to your body. Regular corn syrup is just another sugar. Like a sorghum, or like a maple syrup. So it's not, corn syrup is not that bad. High fructose corn syrup is where,
and I think
it's pretty bad.
Everything in moderation.
Right.
Like if you eat too many tomatoes, you're going to have issues with the acid buildup in your body. So it's just one of those things. If you eat too much of anything, it's not a good thing. So the pervasiveness of corn is just because of the pervasiveness of processed food.
And when you're talking about local, you can't have a tomato, as you say, in December because it's not going to be available, a fresh tomato or okra for that matter.
If you preserve it,
I know. Yeah, but we used to eat seasonally. I remember going to the grocery store with my grandmother, and when tomatoes were in season, she got all excited because tomatoes were in season. We could have tomato sandwiches again. Now you go to the grocery, they're there all the time. Is there something to be said, if eating in moderation is good for you, is there something to be said about the cycle of things not being available and suddenly they are and you eat them for a while and then they go away for 9 months?
look at the way life was 50 years ago. Did we have the problems with obesity? Did we have a lot of the health issues that we have out there 60 years ago? No, we didn't, because people were eating locally. They were supporting local farms. They were eating seasonally. We didn't have half the issues. There's a great book out right now by a great chef named Dan Barber called The Third Plate, who really goes into this in depth. It's an amazing read. And
I think, too, as far as seasonally or seasonality goes, when you don't have tomatoes and you're waiting for them and waiting for them, you're like a little kid on Christmas.
Yeah,
and
right,
you get them and, yes, we've got tomatoes. Yep. It's just like if every day was Christmas, it would be horrible after a while, you know?
It'd be boring. Yeah.
It'd be boring. You have to have things in life to look forward to. I mean, I'm looking forward to September for sweet potatoes. I'm looking forward to next March already. Or April for strawberries. You know, like, you just have things that you look forward to.
Asparagus. Well, three-week time where you're just like, boom, yeah.
Well, aside from candy canes, what do you look forward to in the depths of winter in December and January?
Turnips, carrots,
the leafy
beets,
greens,
collards, kale.
It's about celebrating things when they're in season and then respecting them when they're out of season. Like, on Wednesday, we're doing our tomato dinner at the restaurant, and it's one of those things we're trying to highlight an ingredient and give people something in a way that they haven't seen it before. So it's five courses all about tomatoes, even dessert. So something different. Respect it when it's in season, highlight it when it's in season, and then remember it and appreciate it when it's out of it.
All of you got your start when you were really young, I think, if I read your bios correctly. And Paul, your parents worked in restaurants in Philadelphia. They let you hang
hotels,
around.
Hotels, yeah.
Yeah, but they let you hang around in the commercial kitchens there. You have three children, and your son, Alex, is studying in the culinary program at CPCC. He's worked for you in the kitchen at Heritage. How do you explain this focus on food and restaurants in your family? Is it in your blood
it
somehow?
It is. I mean, when you walk in the door of our restaurant, the first picture you see is a picture of my great-grandfather in his fruit and veggie stand in South Philly.
Mm-hmm.
My sister's in the industry. Both of my brothers were smart and got out of it. We tried so hard to talk Alex out of it. But he loves it, and he's doing an amazing job. I couldn't be more proud of him.
And I read that you were introduced to farm to table while you were working in France.
Yeah.
Why did it take you so long to be introduced? Why did it take France to make that happen for you?
Because at both the restaurants, I was fortunate enough to study at two Michelin three-star restaurants. Both of the restaurants, we got our produce twice a day. Mm-hmm. Our carrots still had the dirt on them. Our leeks still had the dirt on them. Everything, I mean, the vibrancy of it was just amazing. It was so eye-opening. And eating in those restaurants and studying at those restaurants, that was what food should be. And it wasn't what I was doing 18 years ago. It wasn't at all what I was doing 18 years ago. And it really woke me up. And I was like, this is what I have to do. This is the direction that I have to go. And when I was finally able to do my own place. And I've been involved in the farm-to-table movement here for the last 10 to 12 years. But when I finally got my own place, there was no question about what I was going to do.
How fast is this growing in the restaurant business in Charlotte? How important
I think,
is this?
It's huge.
I think, what, half of every new restaurant that I see that's opening up right now seems to be
sourcing
locally.
It, yeah.
I mean, Gus's Sir Beef out of Monroe Road.
It's originator.
Fresh My Farm.
Yeah.
Fresh My Farm.
Is this a throwback?
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to go backwards to go forward, you know?
do you see it as part of your mission to introduce people to new ingredients, to new foods, because they're available now, like Thistle? Is that part of your mission?
It's something that we believe in at the restaurant. I'm always trying to introduce people to new ingredients because I think like I said before, it's a meal of time and place in North Carolina for me. And I want people to understand when they come into the restaurant, we're giving them that. We're giving them a meal of time and a place. And it sounds like a very broad thing when you say it like that, but it really is just that meal for that day right now. And tomorrow may be a different meal, but this is the ingredient we're trying to highlight, and this is what we're trying to show you.
Some of the chefs that we've had a lot of chefs on this program over the course of time, but they talked about being local as kind of a social, moral, ethical responsibility. Is that how you view it as well?
Yeah, I think, respect for our past, respect for ingredients, respect for where we've come from, respect for other people. It's all about hospitality. We're all in the industry because we like serving people. We like... we just like the idea of hospitality as a whole, and it goes outside of the dining room to being hospitable to your neighbors, you know, buying food from your neighbors. And these people that we buy from are our neighbors. So let's help our neighbors. They'll help us.
So we have three restaurateurs. One's downtown. Two are in the suburbs. You're out near Coolwood with Heritage, and you're out in Waxhaw with excuse me. You're out in Waxhaw with Heritage. You are out in Coolwood with the Heirloom.
You're not the first person.
Two H's. On, it's just
– Yeah, it happens. It happens.
What was my question going to be now? If you could write a cookbook describing the cuisine that you serve in your restaurant and you wanted to put it on the cover of the cookbook, what would it be? How would you describe it? Paul, I'll start with you.
Oh, God. Why me first? I don't like to label our food. I don't like to label what we do. I think everything we do is all about the ingredients. So if it was a one-word title, it would be ingredient or ingredients. I don't know.
Okay.
Now, I mean, we've talked about this. We're sort of working on a project at the restaurant right now, and we're calling loosely the foraged fork because we want people to understand that we use foraged ingredients, but it's just a component of what we're doing, and that we're highlighting an ingredient. It may be foraged, or it may just be something awesome from Jamie Swafford's farm. It may be just something awesome from any one of our other farms that we work with. So it's all about just highlighting the ingredients, like what Paul said. But foraging is definitely a big part of what we do.
Okay.
Our tagline from day one has been Modern Southern. We call ourselves a Modern Southern restaurant.
Hence the bacon in the jam.
Hence the bacon jam. with the biscuits, those are my grandmother's biscuits. I mean,
they're good.
thanks. I'm from the South. I'm proud to be from the South. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised here in Charlotte and spent summers on my grandparents' farm in Mississippi. Where they turned me on to farm to fork because that's what they do down there in their small town in Mississippi. But we wanted to say, okay, Charlotte is a thriving metropolis. And we've got all these cultures moving into Charlotte, making it what it is today. And how can we represent them? How can we be respectful of those cultures?
So he's Modern Southern at the Asbury. What are you, I'm going to get this right this time, at Heirloom?
In terms of?
Your style.
Our style? I like to say we're globally inspired, locally sourced. Because for me, Southern cuisine isn't just biscuits and gravy, fried chicken. Like, that's what it is, like, sort of labeled as. When people up north think about what Southern food is, they think about biscuits and gravy and fried chicken. Mm-hmm. For me, Southern food can be anything from a German-inspired dish to an African-inspired dish to a Korean-inspired dish. We have all of these ingredients here. So we shouldn't limit ourselves and say that we cook Southern food and Southern food is this. Like, Southern food can be so many different things for so many different people. So globally inspired, locally sourced.
Heritage.
Or
Provisions.
Well, Provisions is fresh food fast. Provisions is just about fun. Heritage, it's modern American cooking. We do a lot of modern technical stuff. I think is important to what we do. We do a lot of sous vide cooking. Hopefully the health department is listening. We're modern American food. And, you know, I'm a Philly boy cooking with Southern ingredients. Mm-hmm. You know, it's to me, again, it goes all back to ingredients. And like Clark was saying, it's about a time and place. And what we do is cooking in that time and place. And I love it. You know, I couldn't ask me doing anything else.
The Asbury's in the middle of downtown. We have a kind of a critical mass of fine dining restaurants uptown that vary in price, but most of them are pretty expensive.
Yeah.
Because of expense accounts of the bankers, I'm sure it has something to do with it. But fine dining is now becoming it's moving out into the suburbs. There are lots of examples of really good restaurants such as yours. They're in the far-flung suburbs and the nearby suburbs. You're out in Waxhaw. You're out in the Coolwood area off of near Mountain Island Lake, off of Belhaven Boulevard in northwest Charlotte. What do restaurants out in the burbs say about the demand for fine dining and the demand for local foods in restaurants?
I mean, I'm so incredibly fortunate to have guests who support us in that area of Charlotte, and they understand why we're out there. And the reason is we're trying to be closer to our farms. And the idea is that was an area of Charlotte that was a food desert. And we provide a service to our customers. Any of our customers that live in that area can call the restaurant and say, hey, Clark, I need a pound of rice, or I need a chicken, or I need 2 pounds of ground beef. And we sell it to them at cost. because it was our idea that we wanted to provide a service to the community. So in doing that, we've endeared ourselves to the community, hopefully, and hopefully they like us, and hopefully we get to stay there for 10 or 15, 20 years.
Why did you decide to locate in Waxhaw?
It was a business decision, clearly. A lot of it, we were down to a space in Waxhaw and a space in Elizabeth. And I felt like if we took the space in Elizabeth, eventually we would blend in and be white noise. I risked everything to open this restaurant. I risked my life savings. I've risked my family. And to me, I would rather be out on the sidelines and saying, hey, look at me. We're different. We're not blending in with everybody else. And out in Waxhaw, there is no fine dining in South Charlotte. There's none. Except for us in that Waxhaw Ballantyne region. And you know what? The rent's a whole lot cheaper too. And that makes a big, big difference in this business. It really does. And like Clark said, I've got two of my major farmers within 10 miles of the restaurant. I can't beat it.
Chris, you say that Charlotte is on the cusp of doing great things. And yeah. Clark, you say that we're on the tipping point of what was and what could be.
Yeah.
What does that all mean?
I just think that there's, and we've talked about it. I mean, you wouldn't be having this program if there wasn't this influx of chefs who are thinking about what it means to cook in Charlotte right now. And that means supporting local. That means having this great sense of community. I mean, we all hang out outside of work. We're all friends outside of work. And that helps. There's not as much, there's some competition. I mean, we all have businesses to run, but there's not as much just, you know, vile competition, vile hatred for the other restaurateurs. We like to support each other.
All ships rise. Yeah.
We all call each other. We all share ingredients. We all share cooks. It's one of those things. If as Chris's restaurant succeeds, as Paul's restaurant succeeds, my restaurant succeeds.
You know, and Charlotte itself is getting a lot of recognition right now. You've got guys like Paul being quoted in the New York Times. You've got Clark, who's just on Beat Bobby Flay on Food Network. I mean, Joe at Kindred gets written up in Garden & Gun, I think, every month.
Bon Appetit.
Bon Appetit now. So that's going to do really good things for Charlotte.
How important is that? Very quickly, how important is that to
press?
To you guys?
It's huge.
It's incredible.
It's huge. It's huge.
This program is incredibly important. I know how many people listen to your program, and I can't tell you the last time I was on, I can't tell you how many people came into the restaurant and was like, oh, I heard you on Mike Collins' show, and that's why we came in to eat. So, I mean, thank you for having us on.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. That is Clark Barlow, owner and chef of Heirloom Restaurant. You can find him by the side of the road just looking for vegetables. Paul Verica, owner and chef of Heritage Food and Drink and Provisions Food and Drink in Waxhaw. And Chris Coleman, the executive chef at the Asbury Restaurant in the historic Dunhill Hotel right here on Tryon Street across the street from our Spirit Square studio. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you for the biscuits and the bacon jam, too. My gosh.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.